The following program, intended for people who are blind and print impaired, is a production of the North Carolina Radio Reading Service. That program is the Indie Week, the Independent, a weekly publication read today, this week, by John Federson, and the dateline of this issue, January 16 of 2025. And we'll dive right into this week's issue. First off, from Chloe Bowl, a local writer for the Indy, Jefferson Griffin wants to discard my ballot and 60,000 others. The State Board of Elections, a federal judge, and several elections experts have all rejected Jefferson Griffin's attempt to throw out 60,000 votes from November's state Supreme Court election and reverse the results in his favor. Yet the majority Republican court, the same one Griffin is trying to join, recently blocked the certification of sitting Justice Allison Riggs' victory against him, meaning she still hasn't been declared the official winner. Riggs, a Democrat, received 734 more votes than Griffin, a Republican. Griffin is conveniently challenging only early votes and mail-in votes, which tend to lean Democratic, but not ballots cast on Election Day. As it happens, writes the article author, I am one of the 60,000 eligible voters whose ballots Griffin is trying to discard on the grounds that we don't have a Social Security number or driver's license on file with the State Board of Elections. Never mind that, according to the State Board of Elections, there are, quote, numerous benign reasons those numbers may not be in the state database, none of which point to voter fraud. Case in point, after I found out I was on Griffin's list, I called the Durham County Board of Elections to confirm that my voter registration was complete and that I had voted legally. An elections worker named Deborah looked me up in her database and reassured me there was nothing wrong with my registration. The system has trouble with compound names, she told me, and that's likely the reason it couldn't verify my Social Security. She explained, you are a duly registered voter here in Durham County. There's nothing you need to do to fix your registration. Of course, not everyone on this list has a double-barreled last name like me. Some of them may have recently changed their names, voted legally overseas where they're not required to show photo ID, registered long ago under different rules, or simply fallen victim to a clerical error. Griffin and his supporters have not been able to prove one instance of voter fraud amongst the thousands of votes they are challenging. The state Supreme Court's decision last week to temporarily block the certification and consider the ballot challenges fell mostly along partisan lines. Riggs recused herself from the 4-2 decision. Democratic Justice Anita Earls and Republican Justice Richard Dietz dissented. Dietz wrote in his dissent, permitting post-election litigation that seeks to rewrite our state's election rules and, as a result, remove the right to vote in an election from people who already lawfully voted under the existing rules invites incredible mischief. While the state Supreme Court and possibly a federal court work out what to do about Griffin's far-fetched scheme to overturn an election, many Democrats and voting rights advocates are pushing back. On Tuesday, a crowd of protesters gathered outside the state Supreme Court building in downtown Raleigh to read all 60,000 names on Griffin's list aloud. It took nearly 12 hours. Next, over to Durham. Durham schools now have changed their course on the bus plan, and they have paused express stops. We reported, the Indy did, last month the Durham Public Schools Board of Education approved the use of express stops and family responsibility zones as to replacement for the current and messy rotational bus plan, which only guarantees transportation for students 4 days a week. On Thursday, though, as the board huddled on the eve of a just-announced snow day, Chief Operating Officer Larry Webb told the electeds that express stops are not needed after all, at least for now. Rotational service will end after January 17th, as planned, he said. That's tomorrow. Because of the success of new recruitment efforts. But the rollback also seemed to be a response to the community backlash against express stops, which would have required some families at three magnet schools to transport their children to a nearby DPS school that they do not attend, where the students would then catch a bus to their magnet school. Earlier in the meeting, and at the board meeting on Monday, Superintendent Anthony Lewis shared a slew of negative responses to a survey sent to families who would be impacted by express stops. One parent wrote, "If I was able to get my kids to a stop outside our neighborhood at the times needed for this, I wouldn't need a bus at all." Another one wrote, "Unless these express stops are walkable, i.e. within our neighborhood, we have to choose between our jobs and our kids' chosen school. Nice." While the express stop plan is tabled for now, Webb said it is set to be implemented in the 25-6 school year, and that families currently applying to magnet schools have been notified. Despite some board objections, family responsibility zones, which those are certain areas within a mile and a half of schools where families would not receive bus service, are still set to take effect in January 21st after rotational bus service ends. Board member Wendell Tabb came out swinging against the idea of sending children walking through more dangerous parts of the city without any supervision. Under the current plan, any student older than pre-K would be allowed to walk or bike alone. Tabb said, "I love Durham, but we have to be realistic. Some areas we're talking about, we don't even want to drive down those areas. So how can we allow kids to walk in areas that we won't even drive down ourselves?" He added that in looking at potential walk zones, he, quote, "went down a couple of streets where there were pit bulls running loose." Tabb and board member Emily Chavez both worried that the rollout of family responsibility zones would be too soon, and board member Joy Harold Goff mused about the possibility of keeping rotational coverage. Goff said, "We're trading, in my head, one set of eggs that are rotting for another set of eggs that are rotting. I feel like we got one Band-Aid that's not quite working yet. Do we switch one for the other? I don't know." Millicent Rogers, the board chair, reminded members that rotational service, which the board already extended past its original expiration date in December, was never meant to be a permanent solution. Rogers asked, "How do we move forward into a place where we can get more consistent transportation for the most people possible if we push back on the choice that we made in December? I think we have a team that's stepped up and been ready and willing to do the things we've asked them to do. We have to give an opportunity to see if their plan can be effective." Even the administrators who spearheaded the plan, though, don't pretend that it would fix everything. Deputy Superintendent Tanya Giovanni says, "This is our best, worst solution for this unfortunate situation who we find ourselves in." Our next article, also from Durham. On Monday night, the Board of County Commissioners voted 3-2 to approve funding for a new Durham Sheriff's Office training facility on Electra Road. That proposal was originally scheduled for a vote at the November 12th County Board meeting, where nearly 30 residents spoke in opposition to the project. The item was pushed to the January 6th work session at the behest of Board Chair Nida Alam to allow concerned community members, as well as the incoming slate of county commissioners, more time to weigh in before the Monday night vote. Like in past meetings, speakers lined up to voice their opinions about investing $18 million more in a department that received roughly $50 million in the 24-25 budget, the second highest funding obligation after the public schools. Comments frequently came back to a different initiative, the HEART program. Several speakers urged commissioners to expand HEART countywide rather than build the training facility. Since 2022, HEART, H-E-A-R-T, has been a part of the city's community safety department, working in tandem with the police. After initial hesitation, Durham Police Chief Patrice Andrews has been publicly vocal about her support for the program, but several at the meeting said Sheriff Clarence Burkhead has been slow to come to the table about countywide expansion. Commissioner Wendy Jacobs said at the Monday meeting, "The time for action is now. We cannot continue to pay just lip service to implementing best practices to serve our community." Jennifer Carroll, a member of the Durham Community Safety and Wellness Task Force, said that the top priority identified by the task force in 2023 was the expansion of the HEART program. The task force, along with other community leaders, have attempted to meet with Burkhead as far back as 2021, said Carroll, but have been met with, quote, mischaracterizations and with absolute non-response. Carroll went on, "The legitimacy of the sheriff's office is established not only in state law, but also through a social contract between that office and the community it serves. We urge you to vote no on all expenditures, even capital improvement expenditures requested by the sheriff's office, until such time as all parties are willing to participate in that partnership." County staff will present at the March 3rd commissioners' meeting about how to evaluate potential expansion of HEART countywide, according to the night's agenda. Public comments, like the vote, were split. Paul Wilson, a Durham resident of 7 years who lives in the Carolina Arbors neighborhood on the outskirts of Durham County, said a new facility would give the sheriff's office the resources to properly train deputies, satisfying some complaints made by protesters about the department. Quote, "It's difficult to look at the problems we have in the city and county and blame the police or sheriff for not being trained properly when the facility we have is so out of date and inadequate." A surprising voice in the conversation Monday was former state senator and current utilities commissioner Floyd McKissick, Jr. The longtime Durham civil rights leader said county commissioners should not limit themselves to choosing one option for the community's public safety needs over another. McKissick said, "The training center that's being proposed is something that we need. It's something that is absolutely necessary. It's a false narrative to say we can't have all these things. We can have 9/11 consolidated. We can have HEART expansion, and we can have excellent trained law enforcement officers that come out of that facility." In the end, the 3-2 vote split came down to the newly elected commissioners Michelle Burton, Mike Lee, and Stephen Valentine voting in favor, and Jacobs and Allam voting no. But this decision was not a resounding declaration of support. Commissioners who voted yes still held reservations about the sheriff's engagement with the community. Lee said residents in attendance could take their frustration with the sheriff to the ballot box, saying the sheriff is an elected official. If you don't like what the sheriff is doing, his evaluation happens every 4 years. I think our job here is to provide the resources that he explains he needs in order to do the job he was elected to do and the deputies were hired to do. The next article from Raleigh, actually. Will 2025 be the year the construction of Raleigh's first bus rapid transit line finally gets off the ground? It feels like a precarious time for public transit in Raleigh. The regional commuter rail plan is on the back burner. The city held a groundbreaking for Raleigh's first bus rapid transit line along New Bern Avenue, at the time expected to be in operation this year, in November of 2023. Construction is starting, the Indy headline read, only for residents to find out 7 months later there was no contractor to build out the 10 stations and 3.5 miles of dedicated bus lanes along the 5.5 mile corridor. The city has not received any bids on the project. So, the city broke the $90 million project into two parts and re-advertised the new construction plans. Earlier this month, we learned the city received one proposal from Fred Smith Company that was over budget by $113 million, and the council rejected that bid. Now we're back to square one and hoping the third time's the charm. To stay within the city's new $97 million budget for the project, the city intends to split the project footprint in three areas and break up construction into four phases. It will also give contractors more time to complete the project. The Indy asked Brian Sanders, Raleigh's Assistant Director of Engineering Service, and Het Patel, the city's BRT program manager, about the bidding and process and when we might expect the state's first BRT line to finally be up and running. Question: what are the three project footprint areas for New Bern Avenue BRT, and what are the phases? Area 1, downtown to Tarboro Road. Area 2, Tarboro Road to I-440, the Beltline. Area 3, I-40 to New Hope Road. Now, there are four phases to this, and this is organized in the online IndyWeek and in print as a chart, which is hard to describe to you. And so I won't detail what's to go on in each of these four phases. But let's see, clearing of Area 2, as I mentioned, construction of all horizontal elements like roadways, utilities, drainage. That's to be constructed this spring. All horizontal elements, not just in areas 2, 1, and 3, summer of this year, and construction of vertical elements, advertisement and construction duration. That's BRT stations. That's to be determined. How much do you estimate each phase to cost? To maintain the integrity of our bidding process, we don't share our estimates until bids are publicly opened. BRT system has been in the works since 2016. How has the increased cost of materials following the pandemic changed the projection for the project overall? Estimates account for inflation for all components, including materials. These were updated throughout the design process and reviewed following each previous advertisement of the project. The city's goal is to deliver the project within the identified budget. What is the ideal timeline now for advertising and receiving bids and roadwork and station build-out? What's the soonest that BRT could be operational? The ideal timeline is to advertise and award the four packages through this year, with work commencing as soon as this summer. On this timeline, BRT would be operational in the latter part of 2028. Is the city limiting construction to North Carolina contractors? No. The city's interested in creating opportunities for NC-based contractors, but we encourage any contractors familiar with heavy construction to pursue each of these packages. Do you anticipate recovery efforts in Western North Carolina continuing to impact contractors' availability? This has been an impact on much of the regional construction industry. It's difficult to know to what extent this may continue to be the case. We will continue to monitor these impacts through communication among agency and industry partners to adjust our strategy to maximize the pool of qualified contractor interest. And to end this article, the city will host on January 27th, the City of Raleigh, an Industry Day at the Chavis Community Center, where construction contractors can meet with city staff and ask questions about the project. Between articles, I'll pause with this short information about the new editor-in-chief of Indy, in Indy Week, Sarah Willits, who is picking up the baton from Jane Porter, who has led the Indy through that pandemic, its 40th anniversary, launching a new partnership with the Assembly. And so they will, mostly she's pleased to be aboard, and it's mostly a, hi, I'm here, letter to readers. Sarah Willits, the new editor-in-chief. I have a very substantive, long, environmental-type article to read. So first I'll get to this week's Indy Selects, and that's a short section of what to do in the Triangle this week in various formats. There's to attend. Indy Week suggests Lunar New Year Family Day. That's at Art Space in Raleigh on January 18th, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., Art Space in Raleigh. Believe it or not, the days are really getting longer. We're approaching the Lunar New Year and the specter of spring. What better way, along with billions of people around the world who observe this lunar calendar, than to do some arts and crafts with your family? Downtown Raleigh Art Space. You could practice Taiwanese knotting and calligraphy, enjoy cultural performances and refreshments, take part in artist demos, and explore exhibitions and studios, all for free at the perennial nonprofit Visual Arts Center Art Space right downtown. Something to hear, perhaps. The same date, January 18th, 9 p.m. at The Cave in Chapel Hill, Charles Latham and Borrowed Band. One way to beat the winter blues, spend time with Latham and the Borrowed Band, whose witty, rollicking country rock will transport you to a world where love hurts if you do it right, and you might be left unread. But at least there's no landlords. Good news, there's plenty of ways to catch Latham. There's a January 18th show at The Cave with country crooners Ramona and the Holy Smokes. And there's this month-long residency at Ruby's on Five Points, where he'll play every Wednesday in February from 8 until late, and where you can toss back a whiskey among Ruby's signature ruddy lamplight and forget wintertime ever existed. Another thing to hear on the 18th in Durham, Anne Balin with Ali Blois and the Sleeping Hearts. That's spelled A-L-L-I-B-L-O-I-S, Ali Blois. Maybe you're not looking to fight winter, instead wishing to lean further into the season's mystical qualities like brews, brooding, poems, porridge, etc. If so, you'll not want to miss Duke Coffee House's first concert of the season. Duke Coffee House in Durham. And as a Durham poet and songwriter, Anne Malin works a vocal thread that's tremulous and resounding into equal measures, spinning ballads into gold. Ali Bois, also of Durham, the audio engineer behind many of the Triangle's best albums, is a talented musician to boot, with an inspired Baroque pop sound and look that could give Kate Bush a run for her money. Ooh, Kate Bush. Duke students get in free, and town folk can gain admission with a $10 door fee. Something to attend, January 18th and 19th, the Vintage Bazaar at the Expo Center at the State Fairground. The annual Vintage Bazaar resembles a stacked Coachella of indie bands you've never heard of. Vendor names like Expired Rags and Days of Old are absolutely passable as indie band names. But with 500-plus vendors, the largest vintage convention in North Carolina has just about as much to offer as a music festival. You'll find retro video game setups, photo booths, music, food trucks across 2 days, a destination for both vintage sneakers and those tagging along. With higher-end items as well as piles of $5 to $10 goods, the bazaar is an opportunity to bypass fast fashion, support small business, and find a look that's totally singular. There are entry prices, vary by day, and if you want to find more information, they do have a website, the Vintage Bazaar at the State Fair. And finally, something to see, they says, I see in words, Red Desert at the Shadow Box Studio in Durham. As the Poetry Fox, Chris Vitiello has written tens of thousands of poems on the spot at events around the Triangle. Now, Vitiello, who is also Durham's Poet Laureate, brings the spirit of spontaneous creation to his I See in Words series at Shadowbox Studio, where attendees gather in the darkness to pen poems during film screenings. This time, they'll watch Michelangelo's Antonioni's 1964 psychological drama Red Desert, Antonioni's first venture into color filmmaking, and share verses inspired by the film afterward. This is 8 p.m. on January the 22nd at the Shadowbox Studio in Durham. All right, one of our very long-form major articles from Chapel Hill. To reduce its carbon footprint, UNC could burn pellets composed of paper and plastic. On a Friday afternoon in mid-January, college students hugged themselves as they lumbered through the University of North Carolina campus. Temperatures teetered just above freezing. Snow would soon skitter in from the west. A half mile from campus on West Cameron Avenue and overlooking two historically black neighborhoods, several drab apartment complexes and quaint 1920s homes converted to rentals, the UNC power plant labored to keep the campus buildings and dorms warm. Since 1992, the plant has operated as a co-generation facility, burning coal and natural gas to create electricity. Cogeneration also captures the resulting heat, which can be used for energy, improving the plant's efficiency and decreasing the amount of fuel it burns. But now, 5 years past its self-imposed deadline to phase out coal, UNC is trying to wean itself from one of the main drivers of climate change. Instead, the university is asking state environmental regulators for permission to burn up to 22,000 tons of pellets composed of paper and plastic over the next year and possibly beyond. The pellets would be shipped from a Wisconsin factory, according to the draft air permit, to replace only a small portion of the coal. UNC has not disclosed the prices of the pellets, but court documents unrelated to this project show that in 2020, the cost to a Michigan power plant ranged from $50 to $65 per ton. Convergen Energy, based in Green Bay, makes these pellets from hard-to-recycle materials discarded by area factories like laminated paper, adhesive labels, paper mill sludge, PET, PET, and HDPE plastics, and non-woven fabrics like those used in surgical gowns, diapers, and floor-dusting cloths. The company says burning the pellets emits fewer emissions than coal and uses materials that would otherwise be landfilled. UNC did not make a representative from Energy Services Department available for an interview, nor did the university answer written questions about the proposed air permit the cost of the pellets and other contractual terms, and whether other alternatives had been considered instead. The Office of Communications issued a statement. We continue to explore and test new technologies and fuel options as they come to market. This latest permit modification request to test engineered fuel pellets is one step in this process. Plastic is a global problem with few easy solutions. Worldwide, more than 400 million tons are manufactured each year, and only 9% is recycled. Much of the rest is tossed in the trash, on roadsides, into waterways. 19% of it is burned. The Environmental Protection Agency has permitted the burning of plastic and paper as, quote, non-hazardous secondary waste in power plants since 2011, when it implemented a controversial rule designating the materials as alternative fuels. This distinction allows power plants that burn these materials, like UNCs, to avoid being regulated as if they were incinerators. Even though plastics are made from fossil fuels, there is a push by the chemical and waste disposal industries to burn them in lieu of coal. Just last year, the Biden administration committed $186 million in federal loan guarantees to a recycling company that converts plastic waste into fuel. It would replace coal as the fuel source at a U.S. steel plant in Indiana. However, there are unknowns about the technology in general and its full environmental impact. While the pellets divert some waste from landfills, the fuel type perpetuates the production and use of plastic, which harms the environment and human health. At UNC, if the pellets fully replaced coals, levels of some pollutants like sulfuric acid and fine particulate matter would decrease, according to the university's draft air permit reviewed by the NC Division of Air Quality. Greenhouse gases would also fall by 12%. Under this scenario, the UNC plant would still burn natural gas. Yet, swapping pellets for coal would increase levels of several harmful pollutants, such as nitrogen oxide, which can produce ground-level ozone, lead, carbon monoxide, and volatile organic compounds, that latter by 300%. Volatile organic compounds, VOCs, as they're known, are a class of chemicals, exposure to which can irritate eyes, nose, and throat, cause headaches and nausea, and damage to the liver, kidneys, or central nervous system. Some VOCs, like benzene, are known to cause cancer, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Stephen J. Brooks, Convergen's chief financial officer, disagreed with the state's projection and said smokestack testing at the University of Missouri, which uses a different boiler system than UNC, showed no VOCs. Plants that burn the pellets can emit varying levels of pollutants based on equipment, fuel mix, and pollution controls. UNC is also estimating that if it burns pellets instead of coal, the plant will emit more than 11 tons of the pollutant acrolein, classified as a hazardous air pollutant under the Clean Air Act. That emissions rate would rank UNC, as the sixth largest emitter of acrolein in North Carolina, according to the EPA's 2020 National Emissions Inventory. The inventory lists actual emissions. UNC lists potential. The permit application allows UNC to test the pellets for 12 months from the first time it burns them. If it decides to continue to use the pellets, it must disclose this in the air permit and provide an emissions analysis. Alternately, if they decide not to use them, it can remove them from the permit. In an email, Brooks wrote that since 2009, the company's pelletized fuel has been permitted in dozens of facilities across multiple states, but he did not list those locations. Public documents show the University of Missouri at Columbia, a power plant in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and Manitowoc Power Public Utilities in Wisconsin are among them. Some plastics, including a type that Convergen uses in its pellets, HDPE, are known to contain toxic PFAS or can become contaminated during manufacturing, according to EPA. The factory also accepts paper mill sludge, according to the company website, another potential source of the compounds, according to several scientific studies. Brooks said the company does not accept plastics containing PFAS. He said our materials go through an extensive testing and screening process prior to being incorporated into our fuel. But in a single study conducted in 2019, Wisconsin regulators tested Convergen pellets for 26 types of PFAS. State records show the pellets contained four types at a total level of 8.2 parts per trillion. Brooks attributed this amount, quote, to the greater environment. EPA has not set air emission standards for PFAS. In drinking water, the maximum contaminant ranges from 4 to 10 parts per trillion for five types of the compounds. That's a fraction of the estimated 15,000 in use. Traditional treatment methods cannot remove PFAS in water or air. Brooks said, quote, combustion has been shown to destroy PFAS, but North Carolina regulators disagree. It is unlikely the control devices would reduce any PFA emissions, said the draft air permit. Based on the Wisconsin data, the NC Division of Air Quality calculated that the UNC plant would emit just over a pound of PFAS per year. UNC would be required to test its emissions for PFAS annually. That's too infrequent, said Patrick Anderson, staff attorney with Southern Environmental Law Center. Emissions levels for PFAS and other pollutants can vary based on the composition of the pellets. Anderson said, what we're seeing is the composition of these pellets can change a lot over time. I don't think DAQ or UNC have a good understanding of what's going to happen with a lot of these emissions. Brooks said the composition of the pellets is, quote, highly consistent, at least 60% paper or cellulose, and no more than 40% plastic. No trees are harvested for use in the fuel, said Brooks. The company can custom formulate fuels using traditional wood biomass, according to its website, as well as oat hulls and miscanthus, which is a type of ornamental grass. The UNC emissions account for only one part of the overall pollutant load from this pellet manufacturing. It does not include the emissions from the paper mills and plastics factories, nor Convergen's plant itself. Convergen's annual filings with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources show that in 2023 the plant emitted more than 12 tons of particulate matter and 135 tons of greenhouse gases, as well as much smaller amounts of 12 other pollutants. Brooks said all the Convergen manufacturing processes are electric. The plant's direct emissions are from natural gas heaters in the building. In 2022, a data scientist and two engineers studied the emissions life cycle of Convergen's pellets, the transport of raw materials from plastics and paper to the plant, the pellet production itself, the transport of the pellets to the power plants, and emissions from burning the fuel. The authors used widely accepted international standards to compare the pellets' life cycle emissions to those of natural gas and coal. Now, the International Journal of Life Cycle Assessment published this study in 2023. When accounting for the original production of the plastic and paper, the pellets emitted more greenhouse gases than coal or natural gas. However, when the authors removed the original production emissions from the equation, because the pellets diverted those materials from the landfill, the fossil fuels produced more greenhouse gases. Not counting the production emissions, the life cycle assessment found electricity generated from conversion had the lowest global warming potential impact when compared with all other forms of fossil fuel powered sources of baseload energy, said Brooks. The authors also ran scenarios applying renewable energy credits, which they found reduced the overall emissions burden. However, that wouldn't reduce the pollution on hundreds of neighbors of that UNC power plant. The study found further emissions differences based on the composition of the pellets. The greater the percentage of paper or fiber in a pellet, the higher the greenhouse gas emissions. There are some limitations in comparing the results to projections for UNC. The pellets will be burned in facilities within 30 miles of the plant. Conversion, though, is nearly 1,000 miles from Chapel Hill, meaning substantial energy is required in transporting the pellets to North Carolina. Conversion makes its pellets at a plant in an industrial area of Green Bay, best known for its football team. The company doesn't name its suppliers, but roughly a dozen plastics facilities are scattered throughout the city. Several paper mills, Georgia-Pacific, Procter & Gamble, and Green Bay Packaging are encamped near Convergent and along the Fox River, which bisects the city. Since incorporating under its original name, Greenwood Fuels, in 2008, Convergent has been privately held. Its financial status is not publicly available. The company has ambitions to expand its manufacturing to other states, public records show, including Iowa. In 2022, that state's Economic Development Authority Board awarded Convergent more than $500,000 in tax credits for the construction of a new $22 million facility in Fairfax, according to Kanan Kappelman, a Development Authority spokesperson. Convergent in the state signed a contract last November. The funds are contingent on creating 11 jobs by November 30th of this year. However, it's unlikely the company will make the deadline. Quote, based on conversations with the company regarding initial project delays, we are expecting a request to amend this timeline, which will require board approval, said Kappelman. Because of delays, Kappelman said the company has not received any of its incentives. A federal court case reveals there has been financial turmoil inside the company. Convergent has been embroiled in a 5-year legal dispute with its former owner, multinational conglomerate Libra Group, with millions of dollars at stake. Attorneys for this Libra Group wrote in a legal complaint, "This is a case about corporate betrayal at the highest level, a saboteur who stole millions of dollars from his employee with the help of fellow deceitful insiders and corrupt outside investors." The saboteur, Libra Group, alleges is Stephen Brooks, the current Convergent CFO. Since that litigation is ongoing, Brooks declined to comment on the case. As Convergent's senior vice president of investments under Libra, Brooks allegedly committed fraud in 2019 by arranging a $5.8 million sale of Convergent to a separate company, Niantic Vista. But Brooks was also a co-owner of Niantic Vista, according to court documents, meaning he allegedly sold the company in part to himself. in the complaint. Libra officials say they confronted Brooks, quote, with his self-dealing scheme in a face-to-face recorded meeting in Manhattan. Brooks, after repeated denials, confessed to his fraudulent conduct, saying, I'm very much responsible, and acknowledged the knowing participation of the other defendants. He allegedly failed to procure other competing bids, the complaint reads, quote, going so far as to rebuff interest from other potential buyers. The purchase price was at least $10 million less than the fair market value of the pellet plant. The litigation is now in arbitration. A letter to the court dated in 2024 said the arbitration panel could decide the case by later this month or in early February. Convergen says its pellets, quote, provide universities with a solution that's both renewable and more sustainable for steam generation than utilizing fossil fuels like coal or natural gas. Multiple universities have successfully used Convergen fuel to improve sustainability and reduce CO2 emissions. The university began testing Convergen pellets in 2018 after power plant staff attended a conference and met company representatives, said Travis Zimpfer, a university deputy spokesperson. In 2021, the university received a state air permit to permanently burn Convergen pellets in four of the five boilers at its cogeneration plant. State records show. The plant uses about 1 to 2,000 tons of the pellet each year, said Zimpfer. Convergen has been willing to work with us and meet our needs. Zimpfer said emissions data show the pellets significantly reduce sulfur, mercury, and hydrogen chloride emissions compared to coal. Zimpfer said the pellets are about half paper, which makes them considered a renewable source. Obviously, the plastics aren't renewable, but the Convergen pellets don't contain mercury, chlorine, or sulfur, and the plastic isn't going into the landfill, so there are some benefits. UNC sees Convergen pellets as a way to solve a problem identified 16 years ago when the university issued its inaugural climate action plan. At the time, the university set a goal of carbon neutrality by 2050. Then in 2010, Holden Thorpe, the university's chancellor and a chemist by training, announced UNC would be free of coal within a decade. That didn't happen. Only in 2021 did UNC update its climate action plan, which calls for the elimination of coal, quote, as quickly as is technically and financially feasible. To help the campus achieve net zero carbon emissions sooner, by 2040. University had planned to replace 20% of its coal with wood pellets, which it tested in 2010 and 2011. They jettisoned that strategy after, quote, certain assumptions about wood pellet technologies that failed to materialize. Nonetheless, the university has reduced its coal use by two-thirds, but as a result, has increased its consumption of natural gas. That fuel source emits methane, a climate superpollutant, 80 times more potent at warming the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. UNC has cut its greenhouse gas emissions by 37% since 2007, according to university data, which includes those from air travel and commuting, as well as the power plant. They have installed 73.5 kilowatts of rooftop solar panels, which is equivalent to powering 7 to 14 homes, and is pursuing energy efficiency in campus buildings, according to the Climate Action Plan. And the plan reads, because of the urgent and immediate need for climate action, Carolina has set new, more ambitious greenhouse gas goals. Carolina is still researching better long-term solutions. Anderson disagrees that pellets are among those solutions. Quote, rather than wasting time and resources on polluting stopgap measures, UNC should focus on a plan to permanently transition away from fossil fuels altogether. All right, as I reach my closing portions of the broadcast, I could select from a number of long and short form articles, but it's past my lunchtime, and so here's an article about Lionel Vatinet, a local baker who's turned his attention to Neapolitan style pizza. And those of you from Raleigh might know where Creekside Crossing Shopping Center is. 3 minutes before La Farm Bakery's official opening for its new Creekside Shopping Center location in Raleigh, I stood shivering outside in the 20-degree weather, writes the author. I'd come to the bakery to talk to Lionel Vatinet, master baker and La Farm co-owner, about his carbohydrate empire's latest location. Beside me, also shivering, also punctual, was a man stocking up on bread and pastries ahead of last Friday's rare snowfall. $100 later, my fellow La Farm fan walked out with enough carbs to weather any length of winter storm, which is often the case in North Carolina, turned out to be not very long. But he wasn't the only one giddy with excitement about the bakery's new location. While giving an overview of the weather threat Friday morning, the WTVD team delighted over the opening. Anchors John Clark and Barbara Gibbs bantered, "La Farm is coming! Wow! Boom!" While first weather team member Quaylen Murphy added, "I love La Farm." Such enthusiasm is typical for La Farm Bakery. Excuse me, I was interrupted for a moment. Such enthusiasm is typical for La Farm, which has a popular following since its beginning days in Cary in 1999. Well, customers have another reason to be excited. It's also a pizzeria serving Neapolitan-style pizza. Vatinet says, "It was long overdue. We've been talking about this for a long time. Why pizza?" Vatinet says this new addition is just a natural extension of what his team already does all day long, making bread. "Pizza is bread," he reminds me with a twinkle in his eye. "Pizzas start with fermentation, just like bread." For the bakery's first decade, he and his wife and business partner Missy stuck to bread. In 2009, they made their first foray into sandwiches, offering menu items like a croque madame. Since then, the team has had other cafe-style options like salads, quiche, and flatbread to the menu, expanding the offering but keeping the bread as the main protagonist. Vatinet says, "Our progression for the past 25 years went as to what complements the bread." At the new location, customers can choose from several pizza options. I usually like to judge a new pizza spot by its margarita pizza, getting to a pizza's true essentials with no toppings to hide behind. But they were out. Instead, I opted for the prosciutto pizza, which has La Farm's signature chewy crust, a base of creme fraiche and mozzarella, and is topped with prosciutto, arugula, and a drizzle of olive oil. It was divine. A perfect ratio of sauce and cheese to the salty prosciutto with the right amount of floppiness at the base. There are a lot of pizza options in this neighborhood, but La Farm is set to give them all a run for their money. Each pizza starts at $12. Their personal-sized pizza with the option to add on a handful of toppings like French anchovies or grilled chicken. Now, the Creekside Commons location takes about 3,000 square feet, and it will also launch a full bar program in the spring with an emphasis on featuring local breweries and spirits makers, and will stay open till 9 p.m., Monday through Saturday, for dinner service. Omar Gay, who joined La Farm Bakery as COO in 2023 and is leading the brand's expansion, says this, "We're excited to share the next generation of La Farm with this refreshed modern look and feel. On-site bakery, full-service cafe and bar. We're uplifting our flagship bakery at Preston Corners to reflect this, and all new locations will also offer this complete French bakery, restaurant, and bar experience. As for future endeavors, and whether LaFarm will continue to expand across the triangle, Vatanay just smiles and reminds me of his motto, one loaf at a time. And one article at a time will give me just maybe time to read some most of this article about the Full Frame documentary series. And that's going to begin in April. The countdown until this Full Frame documentary festival in Durham. One cinema stopgap in the meanwhile, that festival's Winter Road Show series, which brings three buzzy new documentaries, Union, Daughters, and Hollywood Gate, to the screen at the Carey Theater this month. Screenings are January 23, 30, and February 6, respectively. And admission is free to the public, though attendees must first reserve a ticket through the theater website, Carey Theater. All three documentaries were screened at last year's Full Frame Festival and are on the 2025 Oscar shortlist. Directed by Brett Story and Stephen Mang, Union follows the story of a historic labor struggle, the multi-year fight to unionize a Staten Island Amazon fulfillment center. Extolled by critics as artful and immersive, they take an equally intimate view of ruthless union-busting tactics, egregious working conditions, and imperfect union leadership. Daughters, which won Full Frame's Audience Award last year, is a moving account of a program in a Washington, D.C. jail in which incarcerated fathers prepare for a father-daughter dance. For many, the first in-person contact they've had with their child in years. And in Hollywood Gate, Ibrahim Nashat documents a tense regime change in months after the withdrawal from Afghanistan, leaving behind billions of goods and weaponry for the taking. Nashat is said to have rare but conditional access to the Taliban, and Hollywood Gate reflects this with minimal commentary and interviews. Instead, what's not said is as important as what is said. Well, John Fetterson for the North Carolina Reading Service must bid you farewell for this issue of Indie Week, and we will return next week with the next published issue. In the meantime, this and all previous broadcasts of this program are available as a podcast. Following this broadcast, just go to ncreadingservice.org and look us up. Thanks very much for listening. So long, everybody.